Hello, and welcome to this audio edition of Philip Pusher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparella, and concerts by the CSO on Thursday, October 31st through Sunday, November 3rd, are all Beethoven. The Beethoven Piano Concerto No. 5, The Emperor, and after intermission, the Eroica, Beethoven's Symphony No. 3. Riccardo Muti is conducting this concert, and the piano soloist, Mitsuko Uchida. And here are Philip Pusher's program notes on the Beethoven Emperor Piano Concerto, a work lasting about 38 minutes. It's hard for today's audiences to appreciate the audacities of Beethoven's final piano concerto, the one we call The Emperor. For those who are familiar not only with this great work, but with any of the later concertos that took their cues from Beethoven's example, the grand piano flourishes with which the score begins have little shock value, nor does the size and complexity of the first movement trouble those who not only have traveled its many paths before, but also have come to accept the vast landscapes of Mahler. But to those who packed the Leipzig Gewandhaus in November 1811, this was new music, full of revelations and surprises. To begin with, Beethoven wasn't at the keyboard. This was the only one of his five piano concertos that he didn't personally introduce to the public. Although it wasn't common knowledge at the time, by 1811, his deafness was so advanced, he began to notice symptoms as early as 1796, that he may have turned the work over to other hands rather than admit the difficulties of playing for an audience. In 1815, he abandoned work on sketches for a sixth concerto in D, certain that his performing days were over. Beethoven begins with a single majestic E-flat major chord from the full orchestra, one of those sounds so commanding and individual that today, without hearing another note, we know what is sure to follow. The 1811 audience, of course, didn't know what to expect, and they surely wouldn't have predicted the sudden cadenza-like eruption from the soloist that Beethoven gives them. Hearing from the soloist so early in a concerto is bold and unconventional, but it's not without precedent. Mozart tried it once early in his career, and Beethoven himself had begun his previous concerto, the fourth in G major, with the piano alone. But here, Beethoven isn't striving for novelty. He's preparing us for what lies ahead, a musical argument of unprecedented breadth and scale between two protagonists of equal stature. Only after Beethoven commands our attention with three emphatic chords, each followed by long-winded outbursts from the piano, does he settle down to his first theme, a heroic tune in E-flat major. The piano falls silent, and the orchestral exposition sweeps forward with great energy. This is an enormous movement, lasting some 20 minutes, and it's longer than the following two movements combined. But for all the time and space it occupies, it is not hard to follow. Beethoven alone among composers of his generation knew how to expand the classical structures he inherited without upsetting their delicate proportions or abandoning their inner logic. The slow movement is in B major, a remote key, but one which is familiar from the earliest digressions of the opening allegro. The strings begin with a noble theme to which the piano responds with an eloquent cantilena. Midway through, the piano has a chain of trills that rises more than an octave by half steps, while the orchestra plays broken chords, as if stunned by this daring high-wire act. Finally, there is the celebrated moment when the strings drop from B to B flat, and the piano begins to putter in the makings of a dazzling new theme, which it suddenly unleashes without pause to open the rondo finale. This robust and seemingly tireless music dashes headlong through a generous sampling of keys until it collapses just before the end, leaving only the piano and the timpani to reach the final bars. Beethoven's brilliance wasn't lost on the Leipzig audience, who took it all in and applauded enthusiastically. The critic for the prestigious Allgemeine Musikalische Zeitung reported that this was undoubtedly one of the most original, imaginative, effective, but also most difficult of all existing concertos, words that still hold true today. Beethoven withheld the important Vienna premiere until February 1812, perhaps still vainly hoping that he might be able to take his place at the keyboard. It was his student, the young Karl Czerny, however, who played that night. The response this time was poor, perhaps because this grand and noble work was tacked onto a charity event which consisted largely of Viennese society ladies in living tableau of famous paintings.
Program notes by Philip Huscher on the Emperor, Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 5. And now on to Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, the Symphony No. 3. The work lasts about 50 minutes.
The story of how the Eroica Symphony got its title is nearly as famous as the music itself. We know that Beethoven intended to name his Third Symphony for Napoleon Bonaparte and his fight against political tyranny, that he tore up the title page in a fit of rage when he learned that Napoleon had appointed himself emperor, and that he opted for the title Sinfonia Eroica, Heroic Symphony, instead. The subtexts, idealism and disillusionment, personal greed and the lust for power, the struggle between art and politics, among others, are intense, and they have come to overshadow one of the most remarkable, even revolutionary, works of art we have. A century after Beethoven, Toscanini tried to restore reason, famously brushing aside 100 years of connotations. Some say it is Napoleon, some Hitler, some Mussolini. For me, it is simply Allegro con brio. Beethoven had been contemplating a symphony inspired by General Bonaparte since 1798. Most of the music was composed in the summer of 1803, only months after Beethoven wrote his most revealing non-musical work, the Heiligenstadt Testament, a painful confirmation of worsening deafness and thoughts of suicide. It was one of the lowest points in a life that understood despair only too well. The composition of an important and substantial new symphony was Beethoven's great rallying cry, a heroic act in itself. The first draft was probably completed by November 1803. Beethoven's extensive sketches, nicely preserved and often studied, confirmed that the new symphony gave its composer a lot of trouble. In May 1804, when the news reached Vienna that Napoleon had declared himself emperor, Beethoven felt betrayed. According to the account later written by his student, Ferdinand Ries, when he broke the news to Beethoven, the composer went to the table, took hold of the title page by the top, tore it in two, and threw it to the floor. In fact, although Beethoven had long intended to name the symphony after Bonaparte, he quickly dropped that plan when he learned that Prince Lobkowitz would pay him handsomely for the same honor. And later, after he had ripped up the title page, Beethoven temporarily recanted when he realized that a Bonaparte symphony would be just the thing for his upcoming trip to Paris. In 1806, when it came time to publish the E-flat major symphony, Beethoven suggested Sinfonia Eroica, composed to celebrate the memory of a great man, without mentioning Napoleon. Beethoven's last reputed words on the subject, full of the anger and resentment he surely felt, came later, after Napoleon's victory at Jena. "It's a pity I do not understand the art of war as well as I do the art of music. I would conquer him." History doesn't tell us what, if anything, Napoleon thought of Beethoven's music. When Cherubini, whom he did admire, once suggested that Napoleon knew no more about music than he knew of battle, the emperor immediately stripped him of his offices and power, leaving him with virtually no income. The Eroica is perhaps the first great symphony to have captured the romantic imagination. It's not as openly suggestive as the later pastoral with its bird calls and thunderstorm, nor as specific as the ninth with its unmistakable message of hope and freedom. But to the Viennese audience at the first performance on April 7, 1805, Beethoven's vast and powerful first movement and the funeral march that follows must have sounded like nothing else in all music. Never before had symphonic music aspired to these dimensions. We're told that a man in the gallery shouted down, "I'll give another kreutzer if the thing will only stop." Audiences then, just as today, brought certain expectations to the concert hall, and knowing the length of a piece is one of them, but Beethoven's Allegro con brio was longer and bigger in every sense than any other symphonic movement. The first movement of Mozart's Prague Symphony comes the closest. It's also a question of proportion, and Beethoven's central development section, abounding in some truly monumental statements, is enormous. It is sometimes said that Beethoven was writing without themes at the beginning of the first movement. The comment is not meant disparagingly, but as proof that the essence of Beethoven's language is not melody, but tension and movement. The very opening of the Beethoven consists of no more than two E-flat major chords played forte, followed by the cellos jumping back and forth over the notes of an E-flat triad. The first exceptional event comes when the cellos stumble on C-sharp, a note we never expected to hear, and one that opens unforeseen vistas only 7 bars into the piece. From there, Beethoven continues to spread his wings, even settling comfortably in the very remote key of E minor, just moments before he whisks us back to the E-flat major chords with which he began. Beethoven's writing in the most expansive piece he had yet composed is tight and closely unified. Although analysts often point out the unprecedented use of a new theme in the development section, it's not unique. See Mozart's Symphony No. 33, nor is the theme truly new. Ries was perhaps the first person to be misled by the premature entry of the horn 4 bars before the start of the recapitulation, and he lost Beethoven's respect forever when he rushed up to tell him that the player had come in at the wrong place. It's one of Beethoven's little jokes, all the more effective for being told at a whisper. The coda is as big and important as a movement in itself, but something of this stature is needed to bring us back to earth before we move on. The Adagio is a funeral march of measured solemnity, pushed forward by the low rumble of the basses like the sound of muffled drums. Beethoven raised some eyebrows by placing the funeral music so early in the symphony, but this is music, not biography, and chronology is beside the point. The two interludes are particularly moving, the first because it casts a sudden ray of sunlight on the grim proceedings, the second because it carries the single thread of melody into a vast double fugue of almost unseemly magnificence. The music ends with some consolation, but even more grief. Beethoven's funeral music gives way to a brilliant, though often very quiet, scherzo, just as the prisoners in Fidelio emerge from the dungeon into the blinding daylight. Here, the modest minuet of Haydn and Mozart has become something truly symphonic in scope. Beethoven's finale is a set of variations on a theme he had used several times before, principally in his ballet The Creatures of Prometheus. This is an unusually complex and multifaceted piece of music. It's not just the conclusion, but the culmination of all that came before. Beethoven begins with a simple, unattached bass line before introducing the theme itself. The variety and range of style are extraordinary. A fugue on the bass line, a virtuoso showpiece for flute, a swinging dance in G minor, an expansive hymn. Beethoven moves from one event to the next, making their connection seem not only obvious, but inevitable. Some of it is splendid solemnity, some high humor, and Beethoven touches on much in between. A magnificent coda, which continues to stake out new territory even while wrapping things up, ends with bursts of joy from the horns. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Beethoven's Symphony No. 3, The Eroica. My name is Rich Caparella. Thanks for listening.